Hey, everybody. It's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast, the post-Donald shock edition. Just looking down at my Twitter feed and seeing a picture of a smiling Donald Trump. By the way, you never really get to see pictures of Donald Trump smiling. Grinning over a taco bowl with the tweet, "I love Hispanics." I got to tell you, man, that is that's pretty good. It's like, I don't want to, I can't draw a comparison because any one of them will put me on the unemployment line. So let's talk about hate mail and trolls. I love trolls. Just love trolls on Twitter. Love getting into fights with trolls, particularly between the hours of 6:30 a.m. and 9 o'clock when I'm laying in bed. I'm in a crappy mood and don't want to get up. So I've learned how to chill it with the trolls, but I have to say, I have this weird characteristic, and I want to share a little story with you. I am at gthrush@politico.com, and as you know, on every show, I encourage people to send me compliments or criticism. And it has been pointed out to me that if you send me a nasty gram, I will respond within 30 seconds, right? But if you send me a compliment, and you know, I'm happy to say, or unhappy to say, apparently, that we've been getting a lot of good feedback on the show. I will often be so humiliated, embarrassed, and awkward that I will not respond to people. So I was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner last week, and a very famous person, I will not say who, I just want everybody to know that I actually know a very famous person, and they are compos mentis, they're not out of their minds. I walked up to them, I said, "Hi, X." And X said, "Hi," and walked away. And I followed X and I said, "Why are you pissed at me, X?" And X said, "I sent you two emails telling you how much I liked your Hillary Clinton podcast and you didn't respond." So I lied and I said, "Well, X, I think you went into junk mail." By the way, if I ever tell you that I didn't respond because your email went into junk mail, I am lying through my teeth. And then I realized, why the hell didn't I respond to this person? And the answer was self-hatred. I don't know. I just, it's very hard for me to accept positive feedback. And by the way, if you'd known my parents, you would well figure out why. So this week's, speaking of self-hatred, that's a great transition. Well, actually not speaking of self-hatred, speaking of self-love, Donald Trump. Donald Trump is now the Republican nominee. That is clear. Anything barring the construction of a wall paid for by Cleveland around the convention center won't stop this dude from being the Republican nominee. The irony, of course, I guess irony is not the word here, is that Hillary Clinton still slogs on with Bernie Sanders, who is holding on like FARC in the jungle. Trump is now the nominee, and what we're seeing a lot of are Republicans freaking out. You just walk down Pennsylvania Avenue past any Starbucks, and you see them throwing themselves in front of taxi cabs. The reality with Trump is twofold. Every single Republican candidate down ballot will be asked two questions. The first is, do you support Donald Trump? If the answer is yes, the next question is, Donald Trump just said X. Do you still support Donald Trump? And this is going to go on for the next 6 months, folks. Republicans are screwed on this. Now, Trump may recover. He may do better in the polls. He may take some sort of pill that stops him from saying crazy stuff. But this is a huge issue for Republicans. And really, the last 24, 48 hours, it's all they're talking about. Hence our guest, Mark Salter, is a writer by trade. And a longtime confidant, and a lot of people say the alter ego of John McCain, one of the very first targets of Donald Trump's criticism. Remember, he said that John McCain, who of course is one of the great war heroes of our time, incarcerated in Hanoi, tortured, broken bones, really sacrificed for our country. Donald Trump, memorably very early in the campaign last fall, said that he preferred people who, quote, didn't get captured. Salter came out a couple of days ago with a tweet saying that he supports Hillary Clinton, one of the really few Republicans to actually say that, as opposed to the weasel word formation, as provided by people like Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who says, "I will vote for Donald Trump, yet I will not endorse him." There is no damn difference. If you say you're going to vote for Donald Trump, you're endorsing him. There is no official process. You don't go down to City Hall and get someone to put a stamp on your form of endorsement. If you say you're going to vote for them, you've endorsed them. So Salter has now come out for Hillary Clinton. And so I wanted to sit down and talk with him about that. As it turned out, the conversation was far more interesting than that. Salter is probably, he's one of the more colorful, but also one of the more thoughtful folks in Republican politics. And I really enjoyed our conversation. Think you will too. Some business, the usual business. Please, please, please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. We're doing quite nicely on that. And as I said before, I'm not going to ask for compliments. I just want the nastiest stuff to gthrush@politico.com. Keep it, you know, keep it clean. Keep it non-ethnic, preferably. But I'd love to hear your rotten, horrible criticism, because I really am lousy at my job and a terrible human being to boot. Without any further ado, here's Mark Salter. Mark, let's talk about a little conflict you and I had on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. So I, for anyone who listens to this, the thing that I'm obsessed with is getting Bernie Sanders on here, because I'm from Brooklyn.
Right.
My mother went to high school with Bernie Sanders,
right,
and he will not talk to me. So he's got a very nice PR guy who was a Hill flack named Michael Briggs, who's a wonderful person. And I was a little pissy one morning, and I sort of, I said something like, he's running his presidential press shop like a Hill press shop. And you got pretty angry. Tell me why you got so angry.
Well, I worked on the Hill for a long time, and we've always run a press shop in McCain's office. It was, you know, bent over backwards to accommodate people. And, you know, McCain is very candid with reporters. And, you know, one of my pet peeves would be, you know, every time McCain walks to the floor for a vote, of course, he's surrounded by the scrum.
Right.
You know, he gets off the elevator, they're waiting for him, and they shout questions at him, and he very patiently answers all of them, and they ride down the elevator or they get on the train with him, you know. And then, you know, once or twice a year, somebody will write a snarky thing about, oh, there's McCain, I'll get him to, you know, he'll answer any question. They kind of mock him
right
for talking to him, the very people who are asking him questions every day.
And we don't do that.
No, no. But, you know, and so, it's, you know, people write stuff you don't like. That's part of the business.
Right.
I don't get too worked up about that. If it's wrong, I'll say it's wrong.
Right.
But it's when people, I think, are, you know, and I get your point.
Right.
You know, I get people can, you know, really be strict about coloring in the lines and be unresponsive sometimes, but I also haven't worked on the Hill for 20 years. I know a lot of hardworking people and press shops.
Listen, you were right. I was wrong.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, I started off my career as a very lowly Hill staffer, which convinced me not to want to work on the Hill, by the way. So let's talk a little bit about something a little more contemporary. You were just telling me before we started that you're relatively new to Twitter, but your tweets lately have been getting a little bit of attention.
Tell me
what you tweeted and why.
Well, it was the morning of the Indiana primary. It was clear to everybody that Trump was going to effectively wrap up the nomination. And, you know, there's all this talk about, well, now, you know, when he pivots, when he pivots to the general, he'll start to act more presidential. And what's he do the morning he's about to become the de facto nominee of the Republican Party? He accuses Ted Cruz's dad of killing Kennedy, you know, which I tweeted something that I didn't really think.
It was kind of impulsive?
Yeah, definitely impulsive. I tweeted something along the lines of that the Republican Party is about to nominate someone for president, you know, who reads the National Enquirer and thinks it's on the level. And then I added, I'm with her, which is, of course, the hashtag Hillary.
Right.
Which I thought most people probably knew about me because I've written something along those lines before. I write a column that apparently no one reads for Real Clear Politics every month.
I read it.
I've said it a few times. I wrote something for Esquire in January, which certainly I called Trump an asshole, and it certainly seemed clear. My point is, if my only choice is Trump or Hillary, I'll vote for her.
Right.
And I think I said somewhere that it's because she's the more conservative choice, not a conservative.
She was on the Armed Services Committee with McCain.
Yeah, she is. And I think she would probably, her foreign policy would probably be a modest to maybe substantial improvement over the incumbents. But there's not much of an affirmative case I can make for her. I've never voted for a Democrat for president in my life. But she is the more conservative choice and the least reckless one. She won't or at least she hasn't said that she would take the U.S. out of NATO. She hasn't encouraged other nations to get their own nuclear weapons. She hasn't threatened to slap a 45% tariff on imported goods, you know.
From China, because of course China. Now, you're from Iowa.
Yeah.
Of course China wouldn't ever retaliate.
No, no. You know, and it's not like Iowa farmers sell any goods overseas or anything like that. Right. You know, the 45% tariff, which is, of course, nonsense. It would plunge the entire globe into a depression.
Right.
But these are all things Trump said, as well as, you know, ordering the military to murder the wives and children of jihadis. You know,
which we had people like Michael Hayden, who we had on this podcast, saying that
they would disobey.
It would be their obligation to disobey. Yeah.
So he'd take us into a constitutional crisis. And I think temperamentally, it's been clear to me for some time. I never had to think about Donald Trump in the context of, is this a plausible president until this election, obviously. But I lived in New York in the 80s. I'm aware of Trump. And I don't think there's been a week that I'm aware of in his entire adult life where he's acted like a mature adult.
I've said this before. Yeah.
There isn't.
I have quibble with the adult life part.
I don't know. When has he ever?
Let me interrupt you because I love digressions. Yeah. What were you doing in New York in the 1980s?
Working at the U.S. mission of the UN. I worked for Jean Kirkpatrick. I went to Georgetown, and she was a professor there, and the place was full of Georgetown people. I had a job at the State Department for about 6 months when I graduated, and then all my buddies were working in New York, my college buddies. And
you are from Davenport, Iowa?
From Davenport, Iowa. And I wanted to go hang out with him in New York, and it was fun in the 80s. And
you can smoke. What people don't realize is, and it's true to this day, you can smoke in the UN.
Yes.
And you did.
Could. Oh, yeah. Well, you used to be able to smoke in the Russell Senate office building, too, or right off the floor of the Senate when I worked there so long ago. But, of course, you used to be able to smoke on airplanes. And it's good that we can't do any of those things anymore. But anyway, I knew the U.S. mission of the UN was full of Georgetown people. And so I kind of walked in off the street and got a job.
Where'd you live when you were in New York?
84th and 1st.
Did you like it?
I did. I loved it. Yeah.
And did you, so in the 1980s, that was the tabloid.
Yeah, he was a frequent tabloid subject. And, the guy was just always kind of he's just a bullshit guy, you know?
I think that was the point. I think that's
obnoxious.
What took a lot of people by surprise.
Right. Obnoxious.
I'm a former tabloid reporter from New York. Yeah. I work for Newsday. I guess it's hard to call Newsday a tabloid, but there you have it. It's a fine line between being a... isn't it interesting? We are discovering that there is, in fact, a fine line between being a bullshit artist and a demagogue.
Yeah.
And I guess he has crossed that fine line.
Yes.
Do you think he's truly dangerous, or do you think he's a buffoon?
I think he's temperamentally truly dangerous.
Tell me,
when people say, can he be more presidential? Well, I've had reporters ask me, well, if you were advising him, how would you advise him? I said, there's nothing you can do. He'd have to have a brain transplant. This is who he is. He can't help himself. He was still talking. Well, I just yesterday after Cruz got out, he says, well, Cruz is a hell of a competitor. And then somebody asked him about the National Enquirer thing. He goes, well, I just talk about what I read in the National Enquirer. There's his dad in a picture with Oswald, you know, I mean, it's, and, you know, yeah, we, you know, I'll unify the party, but some people don't want to come back. I don't want him back. You know,
I guess Trump has not read Libra.
Yeah. This is who he is. He's a man of very low character, a very reckless, impulsive guy who seems to spend every waking minute sort of pursuing the greater glorification of Donald Trump and the smiting of his enemies, you know? And
let me bust your balls for one second.
Sure.
So don't get angry at me for bringing this up. You were part of the team in you know where this is going.
Yeah, of course.
In 2008 that vetted Palin.
Yep.
And you were, you guys were not in a, you know, I covered that election. You were in a, I wouldn't say you were in a Hail Mary situation, but you were definitely third and long, right?
Yep.
Tell me, do you have any twinges about not, because one of the things, you know, when I've read the accounts in Game Change and other places, as I recall, the sense was that you guys weren't vetting her with a particularly fine tooth comb.
Well, we vetted her very late in the game. I mean, I'm not going to speak in any detail about this. It would be wrong of me.
Okay.
We asked Sarah Palin to be on the ticket. She didn't invite herself, and she's we owe her our respect
for having done that,
for having said yes. And but you know, we did it quickly. I would only say that our intentions were not as cynical as people think they were. We had a view of her in a change election where the right track, wrong track number was a real problem.
Right.
And the incumbent Republican
was off the charts.
Yeah, in pretty rough shape.
Yes.
It was before, obviously, the collapse of the global financial system. but it was still... I mean, we were holding our own, but we knew we were going to be outspent dramatically. We needed a piece of the change message, and we viewed her or her reputation as somebody that came on, took on the oil companies and took on the Republican establishment and was a real reformer and a change agent. And that's how she ended up getting picked. We did rush the vet, no doubt about it. And, you know, obviously.
Do you think ultimately, you know, the game has been moving in the Trump direction for a long time. A lot of us who like to cover a more conventional operation perhaps haven't admitted it to ourselves. And I put myself in that category. I had picked Ruby. I wrote a column saying I thought Ruby was going to be the nominee, and you supported Ruby. Are you close to Todd Harris?
I always supported Bush too, but by the time Bush was gone, by the time the Virginia primary rolled around, so I voted for Marco. Yeah,
but to some extent, do you think you opened the door a crack for a Trump type candidate because of Palin, or do you think this is just the way the game is going?
No, I don't really think either. Maybe to the first one, maybe a little, and I think this was a very crowded primary. You have whatever 16 candidates or whatever. As Lindsey Graham said when they asked him about his endorsement of Cruz, well, he was my 15th choice.
But he was everybody.
It's very crowded, and it to not take Donald Trump seriously in June and July and August is a rational response to Donald Trump. Okay? It's not like, oh, these idiots, they didn't take him seriously. Who would?
That's right.
Okay? Nobody. The press didn't take him seriously. He was good for ratings. You know, we got, look, what will he say next? You know, and that sound was me slapping my face. But
slapping my face. Maybe you should.
But
did you feel...
Nobody did. And did I feel... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. So... What month did he go after McCain?
Oh God, I don't even remember when it was. It was the summertime. It must have been.
Now McCain is a guy. It pissed me off. He went after Serge Kovalevsky, New York Times.
Yeah, well, that was the one that really did it for me. I mean, I've had an opinion on Trump for 30 some years, but it was making fun of a guy's disability. What kind of asshole does that?
True.
I mean, you don't want a guy like that for a neighbor, for a friend, for a member of your church, for a colleague, for a boss. You wouldn't want, if he had a flat tire, you wouldn't put over and offer to help, you know? So why would anybody want to vote for a guy like that?
You give him
that?
A comb.
So
the Serge Kovalevsky thing even more than the McCain thing?
You know, in a way, you know.
Because that one got me.
You know, we're in the business. McCain's in the business. He's a tough guy. And you know, yeah, it was it obviously that deeply offended me. He, I talked to him when that happened, and you know, I'm sure it irritated him. And I said to him, well, we're going to spend the weekend talking about John McCain, the POW. It's fine. You know, I'm sure.
How did he actually?
He was pretty phlegmatic.
Really?
Like I said, we'd gone through this thing where.
He didn't express that publicly, though.
Well, I mean, he said...
He was pretty chill, I thought.
Yeah, he wasn't upset. I'm sure he was irritated. And he made the point that, you know, if you know anything about the story of McCain's imprisonment, he was hurt pretty severely when he ejected. He broke
into the lake,
three limbs
in Hanoi.
Yeah,
and
they didn't know for a few days he was pretty badly mistreated because they just thought he was another pilot.
Yep.
They didn't know who his dad was, but then when they found out his dad was an admiral, they took him to a hospital. But he was
the head of Pacific naval operations
at that
Pacific.
Time. He wasn't. Right. I think he had the European command. But he would become, I think, a year later, sink pack. But anyway, McCain was in bad shape, and he didn't get much better in the hospital. And he lost a lot of weight, had dysentery. He was in a body cast.
I don't think people are fully appreciative. It's why he can't raise his hands above his shoulder length.
Right.
People should read The Nightingale's Tale.
Yeah, they should. That's a great book. Really bright with fever. And so they put him in a cell with two guys, Norris Overly and Bud Day. And they put him in that cell so they could sort of blame it on the POWs for not keeping him alive because they thought he was going to die. And those two guys kind of nursed him back to health, more Norris and Bud, because Bud himself was in almost as bad a shape. And if anybody knows the story of Bud Day, who actually escaped captivity and got within yards of an American fire base before he was recaptured, crawling on his belly, it's just this heroic, and he was an epic resistor. He just died about a year ago, and very close to him. So, Trump's sort of breezy, which is galling given his own lack of military service.
What was he doing at the time?
He was waging his own personal Vietnam, avoiding venereal disease. he said it, he said it on Stern, I like guys who aren't captured. They're guys like Bud Day and, Medal of Honor winners, Lance Saigon, who died, who resisted to the point where they killed him. Those guys were, pretty much textbook heroes. It just shows you what a vainglorious, foolish, ignorant, low character bum of a guy Trump is.
Do you think do you consider him sort of, and do you think McCain considers him to be an evader, like a draft dodger?
Yeah, McCain's very, he never judges people about that, and he got
really?
Yeah, there's a famous, he had a famous friendship with, my memory is so poor anymore. He was a friend of mine, and I've forgotten, but he died. He was counsel, legal counsel on the first Clinton campaign. Bill Clinton campaign.
But that's different
involved
than...
Involved in AIPAC, and he died about...
But that's different than... these are people...
But that guy had gone to Vietnam.
But these are people who had principle. I have a good... one of my colleagues, David Rogers, who is a wonderful man, was essentially a conscientious objector, and he became a medic.
Yeah, and a wonderful guy.
I mean, to have somebody out there... forget Trump for a second.
Yeah.
The fact that a dude would be in the public... square and a Republican, no less, and say that kind of shit. What does that say about the electorate?
Here's what seems clear to me. That Trump is plainly an awful human being. And if you can't see that, then you've got some kind of problem. And I don't know what it is. And I don't want to be so judgmental of people that I did not grow up in wealth. I'm not part of an elite anything, I don't think. I grew up in the Midwest. My mom was a grade school teacher. My dad was a salesman. I worked on a railroad for 4 years before I ever could go to college.
But you've been out there, and obviously in 2000, that was a really great, that was a really cool moment, whether or not you supported McCain or not, to have that sort of candidacy emerge, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think it's just kind of that the Republican Party is just kind of... gotten to the point where you can't have a John McCain or someone else?
Oh, I would hope not. But here's what the negative reaction. I'm not obviously the only person that can't support Trump in the Republican Party, and there'll be lots more. And I know some people think he'll get 85% of the Republican vote. But if it's 85%, that means an awful lot of Republicans stayed home. I think if you get a normal Republican turnout, I think he'll lose a quarter of Republicans, maybe more.
Which is amazing. Yes.
And I don't think this is going to get any better for him than it is right now. It's just going to get progressively worse.
Do you think he is smart? It's an interesting thing. This is a guy who's really interested in legitimacy, stands up there and talks about how smart he is. Do you think he is like... No. You don't think he's not?
No. And some people think he maybe is kind of like an idiot savant. Because, look at how he just had the right one word insult for each of his rivals, and it took him down. He's just an asshole. You know, that doesn't make him a tactical. You know, I mean, if he were really tactically bright, clever, or something, why on earth would he be attacking rivals after they get out of the race?
After you just said that they're great people.
Yeah, right. Why? What? That's, you know, so no, I don't. I think if he didn't have a wealthy father, I don't think anybody would ever know who Donald Trump was.
It's interesting because he says the same thing about Hillary with the getting 5% with the woman stuff. That's an incredibly damaging thing to say, I would imagine.
Yeah. In her case, she managed to get elected to United States Senate from New York twice and was Secretary of State and an accomplished attorney in her own right.
Now, McCain really liked, as I recall, there's a famous vodka story, right?
Yeah. I wasn't there, so I can't tell. I think it's entered folklore.
It is a little I've talked with her about it. It's a little bullshitty, but there's some. The two of them did actually like each other.
Well, she was an effective member of the Armed Services Committee, and she was very smart the way she approached the Senate. Obviously, senators, especially senators who've been in their jobs for a while.
We're skeptical.
Yeah, and here she comes with her Secret Service detail but she was assiduous in cultivating her relationships and was deferential and willing to help in whatever you did. She served on the Armed Services, with McCain, and
during an extraordinarily difficult time in which they were for a period of time, including up to the surge, were on opposite sides of this issue.
Yeah, correct. And she got along well with everybody. She's obviously, people have talked that there's a Hillary people know privately that is somewhat different than the Hillary people know publicly. And I think that's true. I didn't know her very well. I knew a few people on her staff and I know a few people in her campaign, but she's a very warm, personable person. And I think who got along with people on both sides of the aisle.
And you are a Republican.
I am.
And you are so have you ever considered, was there any other election where it was close? Were you ever considered voting for a Democrat?
No. My first presidential vote was for Gerry Ford, and I voted Republican in every presidential election since. And
how about down ballot? Have you ever voted for a Democrat?
Yes,
down ballot?
I have. I have from time to time when I thought there was a problem with I don't want to name any names, but when I thought there was a problem, yes, I voted for some Democrats.
Has McCain, have you spoken with McCain? We had a story this week talking about McCain speaking pretty candidly about, which is kind of amazing, that Trump would hurt him. Trump would hurt him with Latinos back in Arizona. Why doesn't McCain, McCain has said he'd support the party's nominee.
Yeah.
Would you advise him to say, screw that and just kind of do something else?
No, I'm not going to, everybody's got to make their own decisions. I would advise him. I don't need to advise him. He's already doing it. When Trump says something that's foolish or wrong, you should say so. And he has. He is a past nominee. He's running as a Republican. I know people jump all over Reince, and stuff. Trump won the necessary, or is about to win the necessary number of delegates to be the nominee.
You do about that.
It's very unfortunate, but I wouldn't really want a precedent where somebody can win the nomination and somehow have the chairman of the party refuse to accept that fact. I think it's unfortunate, and I can't vote for Trump, so I'll vote for whatever the best alternative is.
Would you vote for a third, like we've talked about?
I would. If there's a good one that I thought didn't help Trump in some way, if I could vote for a conservative running independently who didn't make it more likely Trump would be elected, then yes, I would do that.
Have you had a lot of Republicans or friends? Well, first of all, let me ask instead of weighing it, what has the reaction been to the fact that you've said this? And, I know you wrote about it, but the tweet really blew up.
Yeah. Well, that's just, like I said, I was new to Twitter and I was just kind of taken aback by the reaction to it. But
Have people reached out to you?
Yes. I've been texted and emailed, but
what's the response? Like, not from schmucks like me, from real people.
You're right.
Silent majority kind of deal?
Yeah. That's, I hear from the Trump people that send me little notes, we're the silent majority. I said, you're neither a majority nor are you silent. But when I grew up, what did it matter to you if the guy next door voted for the other candidate? It mattered to you, was the guy a good guy?
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, did he blast his stereo too loud? Did he never mow his grass? You know, did he abuse his kids, you know? Or was he a good guy? Was he a good neighbor or something? It's like, who cared? Nobody cared.
Right.
You know?
And that's McCain has been.
Well, I think that's all people of a certain, you know, say born no later than, you know, the Eisenhower administration, right, or maybe Kennedy, you know, that it was just someone's politics was not an uninteresting part of their personality, but one of the lesser interesting parts of their personality. It's basically, you know, were they a good guy to hang
with?
But now
it's a signifier, and people use it as
it is, and they can go, and they can only, and you're exactly right. We fragmented ourselves, so you can have meaningful relationships with people and a reasonably full life and with lots of experiences without ever meeting people or spending any quality time with people who think differently.
It's the same thing with, listen, I think it's a part of the Sanders phenomenon as well.
I do. I agree.
You know, if you had Cruz, it would be a straight line sort of, it would be a road test of a philosophy that the party was too liberal, right? And you could at least have proof positive in an election that you didn't have a Romney losing, you had a Cruz losing. Does Trump do anything in terms of creating a moment of transition, or does he throw the party into the swamp?
He throws the party into the swamp. He's because we're identified with his personality. He said outlandish things. I don't think he could slap a 45% tariff on Chinese imports any more than he will get Mexico to pay for his freaking wall.
You could use the actual.
I don't think he will pull us out of NATO, and I think people would prevent him from encouraging Korea to get its own nuclear arsenal. That he wants to do those things is the problem. I don't think he could curtail the First Amendment, but that he wants to do that is a problem. And he wants to do all these things because of who he is, his character, which to me, it just seems like some drunk in a bar. At the end of the day, it's his character that makes him unfit for the office. I think I'm sure 10 minutes into Hillary Clinton's inaugural address, I'll sort of be disappointed. But you know, I don't.
Well, you do have a reputation as being this gloomy.
Yes, but
you look pretty good today, though.
But you know,
it is. I should say the sky is overcast.
Right,
it is, which is a very saltarian.
Well, it's very Maine weather today, so it's normally I would like to be in Maine right about now, but I'm not getting up there till June.
People have that reaction. But we got a couple more minutes. Yeah. One thing I want to talk about is you. You are a writer of some standing. You've written some good stuff. You've written some good speeches for Senator McCain. Tell me a little bit about what it is like being a writer involved in the political process. I mean, is it sort of difficult? Are you kind of a fish out of water sometimes?
No, it's and I've always told my kids this, whatever, if you can write well, once upon a time, I think a lot more people wrote well than do today. And it's still a useful skill that's transferable to all sorts of professions. And it's how I got noticed, you know, is all it was. You know, I worked at the U.S. Mission to the United Nations when Jean Kirkpatrick was the ambassador there. I worked in the press office.
And she delivered speeches.
Yes, she did. They were treatises more than speeches. Right. But, you know, I was a kid out of college. I was clipping newspapers and taping interviews and transcribing. Back in those days, I would transcribe the State Department noon brief out of a squawk box, you know, and clipping newspapers meant actually cutting them out of the newspaper and pasting them and making Xeroxes. But
when you grew up, did you ever have the desire to be a reporter?
No, I never did. I didn't have. I've been strangely free of ambition most of my life. You know, too. I just wanted to. You know,
when did the writing bug? Were you always a writer in school? What kind?
You know, my mom was a teacher and she taught me to read when I was very young. So I was always a reader. And when people ask me how do you become a good writer, become a good reader, and
what were some of the books that really got you early on?
You know, I read a lot of mythology and you know, I to all sorts of stuff, you know.
When you say mythology, like Edith Hamilton.
Yeah, but like Bullfinch's anthologies.
I read Bullfinch's, yeah.
The guy named Clyde Bullis, when I was a real little kid, he wrote the wonderful animal stories or something that
I read. How about Robert Graves?
I did read Claudius, and then I read, I really got into short stories, and I started with Fitzgerald's.
Kid.
And now I become, now it's mostly the Irish short story that interests me, and I read a lot of them. William Trevor is my favorite writer.
William Trevor is terrific.
He is.
By the way, not exactly an uplift.
No, but you know, he lacks sentimentality, but he's filled with compassion. And that's
it's McCain-ish.
It is in some ways. Although there's plenty of sentimentality sometimes in McCain, I think. But and his stories end that way, in a way that an awful fate might have befallen his characters. Right. But he accommodates you and them to it. You can feel his love for his characters. And that's a rare ability that very, very few people have.
What do you think the best thing you've ever written is?
You know, it was probably some floor statement or something I wrote for McCain.
Really?
I imagine. You know, it's a funny thing. The best things always end to be the things you sort of dash
fast.
Off.
You got it.
Under pressure. And you know, because you economize. You're not even economizing. You just don't have time to not economize, you know. You know, I'm proud of the first McCain book. I'm actually proud of the one that came out right after in 2007, the summer. We'd gotten a decent advance to have a book come out that August because McCain was considered the presumptive front runner. But the campaign kind of blew up in July, and so the book never sold. And I had to write that book in 2006. So your boss is running for president in 2008, you're pretty busy in 2006, right. You know, and I was still chief of staff for him at the Senate office, and I didn't want to do this book. I just told our publisher, John Karp, that there just aren't enough hours to do it.
Yep.
So, well, we'll give you more than we wanted to give you so you can hire a researcher, which was the first time we used a researcher, a marvelous guy that's done work for David McCullough and John Meacham and others, by the name of Mike Hill, if anybody's looking for a fantastic researcher out there. But so we hired him. But I, you know, I would just come home at like 9 o'clock at night or something.
After a day.
Yeah, after a day at 9 o'clock at night and have to write for 4 hours. But he had everything in a binder for me so I could do it. But again,
it was just. You listen to music? How do you?
I do. I listen to usually Mozart. Everything else. If in the morning to get me going, I'll listen to Bach.
Mozart is non-intrusive.
Yeah.
Bach is too mathematical and complicated. You get caught up in it.
I do it in the morning just to get myself going.
Yeah.
Well,
one thing I want to ask you, because I've never had to do it. I've had to do it. It's why I'm a really shitty editor, because I rewrite. My voice is very strong. Yeah. Your voice is really strong, too.
Yeah.
What is it like having to speak through someone else's teeth?
Yeah.
Somebody who very clearly has a voice.
It's a little bit of a trick, and I think it largely depends on who it is. You know, everybody has a biography, obviously. And if you can learn to write from the vantage point of how you would imagine you would see the world if you had that biography, then it's not that hard to do. You know, you don't have to put it in. You don't have to make references to the biography or something. You just have to write from the perspective of somebody who has seen that kind of slice of life.
Being McCain. Your case, McCain.
McCain.
And McCain is, do you consider McCain almost to be a character in a narrative?
Yes.
To yourself?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, probably.
When did you first get hooked on it? It seems like you're a little, I don't want to use the term addictive, it's pejorative, but it seems to me like you got caught. It's a very Boswell Johnson sort of thing.
Yeah, well,
right?
We were friends. You know, we hit it off right away. I was working for Kirkpatrick, and we were at the convention in New Orleans in 1988. I had written her convention address, and I tell this story all the time because it's just when people, well, what was your game plan? I never had one. Life is just a series of fortunate or unfortunate accidents. And so it was in the Superdome, a big place. And nobody had cell phones back then, obviously, or anything else. And the surrogate press shop had asked her to do a bunch of interviews. And it was late at night. And we had done about four or five. And I couldn't find the last one. We were lost in the Superdome. And she's getting a little irritated. And I'm not going to do it, you know. And so I somehow got a walkie-talkie or something and got the press surrogate press shop at the convention. Send somebody up here that knows where this fucking interview is, right. You know. And they sent up this volunteer who took us to the interview, and I started, shooting a breeze with her, and got along. Went out and had a few beers that night. It was Tori Clark, who at that time was John McCain's press secretary and had been his press secretary
later
when he was in the House.
State
later
Department
went on to Defense Department
spokeswoman.
And worked in the George H.W. campaign, re-election campaign, and just became a great friend. And we went out and had a few beers. We're walking down Bourbon Street. She introduces me to one of her colleagues, who was McCain's scheduler. And then she introduces me to McCain the next night at the floor of the convention when Bush was giving his acceptance speech. And kind of hit it off. And they hired me to write a speech. He was getting an award from, I think, La Raza or Lulac or somebody. And it worked, I got his voice on the first try. And
what was it like working with him on that?
Good.
Is he prickly or?
No. It's just, he's just quick. Not prickly at all. He's very casual. Everybody, the interns call him by his first name.
He's funny.
Yeah, he's funny and jokes around and he's restless and you do your business and you're
right.
The next guy.
He seems to have this unique capacity to actually give a shit about somebody he's talking to.
He does. He does.
I mean, you do get the feeling politicians can project it, but mostly it's a pretty narcissistic thing. There are times with McCain, like any famous person, where he feels importuned upon, right? And he'll call you into the elevator. He's like, "Get in here, you little shit." Yeah, that was what he would say.
Yeah.
But there are moments you will say something where it'll break through and he will actually focus on you as a person. I find that unusual with politicians.
Yeah, he does. But anyway, so he called me in again to do some other speech for him, and I did another one for him. And then he called me in, I think in the summer of 89 or... He said, Lauren, who's in his foreign affairs, LA, and Lauren's going over the State Department, and I want you to come here and be the foreign affairs guy and write stuff for me. Okay, talk to Chris about the money. And I said, well, can I have some time to think about it? And he said, yeah, but like do it quickly. And so I ended up going to work for him, and his scheduler, I ended up marrying, and we have two kids. And I always tell people it's because I got lost in the Superdome.
So did I think.
And the rest of my life happened.
And by the way, I think George H.W. Bush got lost in the Superdome too. Like literally, I think it's in what it takes. Well, last question is highs and lows with McCain. What was the moment that you felt was sort of his apex? And what was kind of the lowest moment? What's it like being around him? Because this is a guy who has dealt with a ton of adversity.
A couple. I don't know which one was greater. The Vietnam normalization was a big thing. Very proud of him. He got Clinton the authorization to use force in Bosnia. That was tricky. Because it was in the middle of a presidential election, and the guy he was supporting, Phil Graham, at the time, was opposed, and that was a big high. There have been lots of highs. I mean, a small, and I think it was 93, maybe 94, maybe 92. He was asked to give the commencement address at Naval Academy, which his father had given when he was in prison, and it meant a lot to him. It's weird.
Why?
You know, he's got, like anybody, the son of and grandson of admirals, and went to the academy himself, had complicated relationships with the Navy, who suffered greatly in the Navy, but was proud of it, I think. And he wanted to do as well as his dad had done. And it was just a uniquely touching moment.
And you worked with him on that?
I did.
How long a process was that?
Longer than usual. Usually it's pretty quick with him, because we've been doing it a long time together.
Was it hard for him to come to?
He was involved in every paragraph of it.
What does it feel like to blend with somebody?
That's right there.
Right on your wall with you're pointing to a congressional record.
Thing. Yeah, Graham, I think, had submitted it to the record after he gave it.
What's it like? That must have been a moment where you two became. Was that a forging?
I think we were close right from the jump. You know, we have similar personalities, and
but he likes writers too.
We read the same kind of stuff, and he's a big Trevor guy. And
I didn't know that about him.
He's more of a Hemingway enthusiast than I am, but.
I went back and read Central Suarez as a.
But we were always exchanging books. I mean, because I was at Foreign Affairs LA, I traveled overseas with him.
So you spent a ton of time.
Yeah.
Wait, but back to the speech. I don't want to hunker you down too much. But back to the speech. What was the thing? Sounds to me like he was having trouble. These are a complicated stew of things.
Not trouble. He just wanted to do right by it. He had all this. I mean, there's been a McCain in uniform since the American Revolution.
Right, there was that great PBS. Did you see the PBS special where he apparently is related to George Washington?
His cousin is related to Charlemagne.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a centuries old.
So he felt the tradition. He felt the weight of this.
Yeah, and the weight was from the day of his birth. You know, born in the Panama Canal Zone. You know, his dad.
But there's also an ambivalence. But you were getting in an ambivalence too. So the way of the pressure.
Right. Well, I mean, he's not the only midshipman who has bittersweet memories of the Naval Academy. Most of them do. You know, it's I think it's a little bit easier than it used to be, but it could be, especially that plebe year, it could be a pretty wretched experience. But he's pugnacious. And as he said, I didn't, you know, really understand why I had to defer to people just because they were a year older than me, you know, but, you know, I mean, he had made his peace with all that decades and decades and decades ago, and he'd been in civilian life since 1980.
Right.
You know, but it's a big deal to be asked to give that address. You know, his father and his grandfather were the first father and son to be four-star admirals. You know, it is a big family tradition. And there he stood, you know, Eisenhower had given the address.
Do you think there was self-doubt involved?
No self-doubt. He just wanted to do a good job. He wanted it to be a memorable experience for everybody involved. And it was for years. I heard afterwards the plebes were given a copy of the address.
That's a pretty cool, that's a pretty cool thing for you.
Yeah. It was nice to be able to, you know,
to be part of that.
To be part of it.
I guess the last question is the low. I mean, you were with him the end of 2008. It was really tough.
Yeah.
It was also represented sort of the unwinding of, he's gotten back to it, but presidential elections change the way people view people, change the way they view themselves. What was it like? What was the low on that?
You know, I think election day wasn't really a low. It was pretty obvious what was going to happen after Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Right.
So at that point, I mean, there are many people. I've tried to find the dominant, character trait in McCain, and I always toggle back and forth between his restlessness and his resilience. And I've decided that they're one in the same.
They are one in the same.
They're one in the same.
Absolutely.
You know, he just cannot stay in an experience. It bores him. You know. So, you know,
including grief, pain.
Yeah.
Right.
He's got
also happiness.
He's got to move on. And that's how we ended the first book, which ends when he gets out of prison. He says, you know, I just, you know, held on to the memory and moved on, you know, because that was the most authentic. That's so authentic to McCain.
He did not get so down.
You know, it's going to happen for at least a month. And what's resilient, the resilience comes in is you got to do 8 or 9 airport rallies every day, and you're in like 5 or 6 states every day, and it's just like 20-hour days, and it's a terrible, exhausting grind of an experience, and you've got to do it with gusto every day, and you know you're going to lose. You know, that takes some how, kind of fortitude.
Okay, so here's a dismount. We're talking about Trump. We're talking about character. There is a possibility. Who knows? You know, Trump could run the table, and the world could, you know, turn flat.
Yeah.
How do you see Trump? There might be a long stretch here where Donald Trump is going to be aware that
he's going to lose.
He's going to lose. How the hell do you think he's going to deal with that?
Well, I think he's kind of an unstable personality to begin with, so I couldn't really hazard a guess. You know, I think he could come apart, you know, in some kind of visible way. I think that's quite possible. But
do you think he is so unstable that he
I don't think he's psychologically well.
So you think this process, the pressure?
I'm not a psychiatrist, but he just there is something wrong with a guy that.
So you think the end game here could be Donald Trump having some sort of a breakdown?
I guess that's a possibility. I don't know that would happen. I don't think he's a stable person. He certainly doesn't behave like one. You know, it's almost a compulsion with him. You know, this is all about, you know, how dare you insult me? You better respect me more, you know? And, I mean, it's pathological, you know, any sort of slight is, I mean, his tweets are like some, like, I think it was Mark Halperin and John Heilman or something. I'm beginning to respect them. Because they didn't criticize him or something. I mean, what? Grow up. You know, it's grow up. You know, the whole thing with Megyn Kelly, you got the, sometimes I thought the guy had some kind of secret room in Trump Tower. The walls are plastered with pictures of Megyn Kelly cut out of magazines or something. It was just weird. You know?
It puts the lotion on its skin.
Yeah.
Boy, that I really don't want to end on that one, man, because that is creeping me the hell out. So I guess I will just ask you, what are you working on right now in terms of? By the way, that is not a nice question to ask anybody.
Yeah. No. You know, I've got a few clients I write op-eds and speeches for, and I try to do a book every other year, and I'm trying to sell a book proposal that I was really lucky to get invited to work in a very limited way on a Ken Burns documentary that's going to air in a year from next fall. And I met this guy there who had been a Marine in Vietnam and grew up in Roxbury and gangs, single mom, tough life, good football player, but rough year in Vietnam, Marine up on the DMZ and all those fire bases up there.
Yep.
And then came back and somehow got himself through college and became a great education reformer, ran the biggest charter school in Boston. I think the guy's got a fantastic story. His name's Roger Harris. I've tried to sell the proposal to a bunch of publishers. Nobody's bought it yet, but somebody ought to write this guy's
people
story.
People do listen to this, so maybe they... Well, Mark Salta, great meeting you. Great talking
good
to you.
Good meeting you, too.
Thanks for being on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The song this week is Not Yet by the LA-based band Fun Game.